America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. Larry Rifkin along with John Krofcik. And John, a very interesting topic for our listeners today about a group, a gang that a lot of people have heard of but don't know a whole lot about. It's called MS-13. And some say it's the most notorious gang, street gang, in America. But do we really understand who they are and how they came about?
They come into the news. I think they book up a big gang out on Long Island, and then they're out of the news. So you don't really hear about much about MS-13 as you did. You know, it seems like the way the news cycle runs, they pick these things up and then they drop them.
Yeah, that's an interesting point that Long Island case got a lot of attention, because basically, John, MS-13 is a group of El Salvadorians who came here over the years. And it started out really, John, when you think about it, as a relatively harmless social network. And believe it or not, John, it was bound by metal music and their Salvadoran identity. But later, they kind of had a bump up against other local gangs in Los Angeles, because that's really the fount of MS-13 in the United States. And they took on a lot harder edge when they began to go up against these other gangs. And I think we've heard about the other gangs in L.A., the Crips and the Bloods and others.
Well, it's kind of funny. That's how the mafia started, right? When the Italian immigrants came to this country, they were mistreated. So the mob was kind of a nice social group to help them out. And they turned into a notorious gang of people. You know,
you're absolutely right. I mean, it's really started as more of a social network for the individuals here, as you say, and then it morphs into something else. And it's something that I think we all want to understand better. I know that the Trump administration, the past administration, very much paid attention to MS-13, and we heard them excoriate the group from time to time. But let's understand a little bit better what they were born out of. And in many ways, John, they were born out of policies that push people across the border and into the United States. So we're going to get a real lesson today. We're going to be schooled on how MS-13 came about from Stephen Dudley. And he is the co-founder of Insight Crime, a think tank devoted to organized crime and corruption in the Americas.
You know, I like these. You every so often you do these mafia type stories, these crime stories, and they're fun. They're fun, and they're also it teaches a lot what's going on and around, you know, that we don't, like I said, we don't really hear about too much.
Well, you say that because you know that in radio I was one of the people who had access to the real Donnie Brasco a couple of times, and we interviewed him, and his name, of course, Joe Pistone. And I had to remind people, John, if you recall, because there was still a bounty out on him, that he was not in the studio and that I didn't know what his real phone number was. It was disguised because I really didn't want any of those wise guys coming after me, John.
That's right. I remember that. That was quite an experience. That was, you know, we'll have to find that sometime and re-clip that up. That was a good one.
Yeah. In fact, I got to interview him twice. So, again, I thought your analogy was really appropriate. about the modern immigrant and the perennial battle to escape poverty and crime and the way they organize themselves. So we'll learn more about that today here on America Trends. With me on America Trends is Stephen Dudley. He's the co-founder of Insight Crime, a think tank dedicated to organized crime and corruption in the Americas. And he's written a compelling book called MS-13, The Making of America's Most Notorious Gang. And yes, even you tell us that they are, quote, the bastard child that no one wants to acknowledge from an affair that most choose to ignore. And that in many ways, they don't feel like the normal gangs that we have seen, the Crips and the Bloods and like. So who is or what is MS-13?
MS-13 is the, it is, a transnational gang would be the simplest way to explain it. The most complicated way to explain it would be to say it is multiple transnational gangs, because it is very, a big, sprawling, somewhat informal network. These networks are spread out into what are called cliques, and they span to a dozen states or more and six countries across the region. The group itself was born in Los Angeles, really circling around a specific sort of theme of sorts, which was they loved heavy metal music, of all things. But this was Los Angeles in the early 1980s, and it was a rough and tumble place during that time period. Lots of violence, lots of competition for not a lot of resources for immigrant groups that were coming up en masse, like the Salvadorans from El Salvador, that formed really the core of the gang in the 1980s. And, you know, it evolved from there. It became a much more criminal gang over the years. But the essence of it is this transnational gang.
The story of MS-13 begins with El Salvador's civil war. And that went on for about 12 years. It left 75,000 people dead, over a million people displaced. And out of that came a lot of refugees, and many of them ending up in Los Angeles and looking for some kind of social connection, and thus many of them found their way into MS-13.
That's an apt description of their beginnings, to be sure. I mean, this is the result of massive displacement, disjuncture, disunited families. You know, this is the essence of most gangs. When you think about gang evolution in any part of the country or with any recent immigrant group in the United States, you know, think back to the 19th century with the very famous Irish gangs in the Five Points, the famous Dead Rabbits is what they were called, you know, back in New York City, made famous, of course, by movies by the likes of Martin Scorsese. Those are the things we think about, and it's not too different in the case of the MS-13. The core group is made up of Salvadorans who are running away from a country that is at war. That war, by the way, is, you know, in the regime employing that war, often on its own citizens, is backed up by the United States. So if we really want to start the sort of history of the gang, we have to start with the Civil War going back to the 1980s in El Salvador, which is what leads to these refugees going to Los Angeles.
And yet we often hear, well, these gangs are just so malevolent. I know that Donald Trump has made them a number one target for the United States. And we continue to see so many people displaced in places like El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and the like. What gangs are those, the ones who really have brutalized their own citizenry? MS-13, if they were really born out of refugees looking for a social connection in the United States, how have they traversed back into those countries, and how are they related to the violence that we often hear about in Central America?
Well, a major part of the book is trying to unravel that evolution. And the evolution is really moving along sort of two parallel tracks. One track is the way in which the street gang itself evolves in a very competitive criminal environment. So it goes from these music lovers to, you know, people who maybe carry knives, to people who are carrying machetes, to people who are carrying, you know, handguns, and then eventually assault rifles. You know, that kind of violent evolution that occurs inside of a gang because of what's happening around it, because of their own needs. Their needs change. You know, they might become more involved in criminal economies, in particular in the drug economy or in the extortion economy. And then parallel to that is the way in which we respond. When I say we, I'm talking about sort of, you know, societies writ large, but also, you know, very specifically police and police responses. And those police responses are governed by the idea that we can jail our way out of this problem. And that's precisely what they try and do in the early 1980s and through the 1980s, with not just with the MS-13, but with all kinds of gangs. You know, we're going to jail our way out of this problem. They jail them en masse. And so these, now the MS-13 members, and particularly their leaders, are in jail. And while in jail, they come in contact with other criminal organizations, and they mature. The specific organization that is sort of their umbrella group inside of the jails in California is known as the Mexican Mafia. And they mature under the umbrella of the Mexican Mafia, which is known as the Southerners or the Sureños. There are as many as 50 gangs that are underneath that umbrella. When they are released from prison and they are ex-convicts, they begin to be deported. This is another decision on the part of the United States government. They're going to deport them en masse. And they do. They deport them in the thousands back to places like Central America. Specifically, in the case of my book, I talk about them returning to El Salvador, where these guys have more know-how, they have more cultural cachet, they have understanding of use of weapons, and they have this sort of, you know, allure that comes with having been brought up in this gang environment in Los Angeles and everything that goes along with it. And they very quickly usurp the local gangs in places like El Salvador. So that's why you get the brand name of the MS-13, which starts in Los Angeles, spreading to other parts of Central America, and then spreading to other parts of the United States, really under the same rubric, this idea of cultural cachet and, you know, grouping these people together and usurping the local gangs that operate in those spaces.
You tell us that the brutality is most evident in Central America. Why is that, as opposed to within the borders of the U.S.?
In the U.S., this strategy of jailing our way out of the problem is more effective. You know, the United States jail system is better in many ways. And the violence that they, you know, commit leads to, you know, just huge, you know, amounts of resources dedicated to going after them. So you get this pattern in the United States, which is you'll have spikes of violence in different parts of the country. You know, some of the listeners may remember 2016, 2017 in Long Island, which got a lot of attention because of, and, you know, and then subsequent visits by Justice Department officials, such as the Attorney General at the time, Jeff Sessions, and also President Trump himself, visiting those areas because there have been these spikes in violence. After that, there was a huge amount of pressure, law enforcement pressure, which pretty much damped them out. But I would be, you know, it's basically the pattern would be they're going to emerge again in the next 2 or 3 years, because that's the pattern that we've seen in the United States. In places like El Salvador, they're not wholly, or they have never been really, wholly prepared for what fighting gangs like this entails. They don't have the infrastructure, the prison system, the ability to sort of squash the power of the gangs and the numbers of the gang members themselves. They exist in far greater numbers in places like El Salvador. Whereas in the United States, in a place like Long Island, you'll have cliques, these small cells, right, that will be anywhere between 10 and 15 people. And in El Salvador, there will be anywhere, these same cliques will be anywhere between 50 and 70. So you can, it begins to sort of, you know, become clear that it's much harder to corral them in these places because there's many more of them. The infrastructures are worse. The policing is worse. And the judicial system and, you know, rule of law in general is just worse. So all of these things contribute to them to being a much greater problem in places like El Salvador and leading to many, many more deaths.
You say that MS-13 is like a surrogate family. The members join for many reasons, but mostly because they're vulnerable, marginalized, lacking any clear way to climb the social and economic ladder. You say that economics is not necessarily the key reason for their exploits.
It is part of what makes them who they are, but I think the core part of what makes them who they are is that they create a community. We don't want to think of it as a community. We don't talk about it like it's a community, but it's a community. It's a community with a shared identity. As I mentioned earlier, that shared identity early on was really music, but also shared national identity, shared ethnicity, shared way of speaking. You know, there are lots of things that bring them together, but perhaps the thing that unifies them under this sort of cocoon is that they feel protection. Again, we don't want to think of it that way, but that is the reality for them. They come, many of them, most of them, come from very difficult circumstances. And that's really what the book is about. It's about contextualizing, not justifying who they are, but contextualizing who the individual members are. And I spend all of my time chronicling various members of the gang, current and former, so you can understand where they come from and the decisions they make. We may be in disagreement with those, and certainly I am in many instances, and do my best to chronicle exactly what they do so that we're not seeing a romanticized vision of who these people are. They are doing some bad things, of course, but their decision-making process makes a lot more sense when you get closer to their reality. And certainly all of them go through a metamorphosis of sorts, which is that they're enamored with the gang at first, and they may think of it as a protective cocoon. But over time, they almost all of them flee the gang because they understand that the gang is their worst enemy. But this is over time. It doesn't happen initially. Initially, it's this sense of being inside of this protective cocoon that they enjoy.
Stephen Dudley is our guest. MS-13, the making of America's most notorious gang. Give us a profile of a person who may move into MS-13, and when would they ultimately perhaps move out? I mean, what are the ages? Is it totally male-dominated? And in Los Angeles, I'm curious how they do work and interrelate with other gangs that we've all heard of in Los Angeles, the Bloods and the Crips.
Well, at the center of my book is a character, is a person who I call Norman. Norman comes from pretty, you know, typical downtrodden Salvadoran family. He grows up in the middle of the Civil War that I referenced earlier in the 1980s. And his family is torn to shreds because of the Civil War. His, you know, one of his brothers is forcibly recruited, actually in front of his mom. The military comes to the house, takes two of his brothers, and gives his mom a choice. So she has to choose between one of them. She brings one of them home, leaves one in the military. Her dad leaves his mother during that time period. She attempts to kill herself. And by the end of the war, the family is torn to shreds, you know, in terms of where they live. They all scatter to different parts. Most of them go to the United States. And some of them up in the United States start to join this fledgling gang, the MS-13, in Los Angeles specifically. They're later, you know, deported back via the same process that I was mentioning earlier. And that Norman begins to come in contact with these deportees, including some of his brothers, and he joins the gang full on. You know, in the 1990s, you know, in the midst of this tumult. And, you know, he's the central figure in the gang because his life is, you know, the trajectory of his life really mirrors the trajectory of the gang. He eventually gets thrown into prison in El Salvador, where the gang goes through another evolution and becomes an incredibly powerful, you know, entity inside of El Salvador, and literally uses the jail system at its point of operations. And by the end of the book, what you have is a person who is, you know, disenchanted with the gang and is literally fleeing the gang to the United States. And that's where I met him, was in the United States when he was into the, he was in the immigration system seeking some sort of relief from deportation, because he said he had two major enemies back in El Salvador. One was the gang and the other was the state. So this is a person who had gone through all of these phases of gang life. He was in his 40s when I met him. Most gang members will age out over time. They will age out, they will get jobs, they will have families, all of these combining to just sort of give them other interests and needs and motivations for life. And they'll age out, you know. Some of them will leave or ask for permission to leave. They can in some instances if they convince the gang that they are involved, for example, with an evangelical church. But most will just simply age out and they become retired, or what they call semi-retired. The literal word is calmado, but it, you know, it means sort of semi-retired. They won't necessarily ask for permission. They just get old and they just leave them alone. This is a typical trajectory of gang members from a very hardcore gang like the MS-13. It's much harder to leave the gang in a place like El Salvador than it is in the United States. But nonetheless, it can happen in much the same way. So, you know, this is a sort of typical trajectory. Norman would represent that typical trajectory.
During this period, MS-13 has been used to symbolize the hazards of allowing what has been considered unfettered immigration. But this is really a reflection or a manifestation of flawed U.S. policy towards Central America for a very long time. Can you tell us, during the debate about immigration that's been ongoing for at least the last 10 years, but intensely the last four, and preceding that, U.S. Central American policy, how all of that comes together to aid and abet whatever the motivations of MS-13 and others who might join a gang are in relation to being on American soil or going back and forth between America and Central America?
Well, the way we often think about and talk about immigration is that we boil it down to the individuals who are making these decisions. And we talk about it as if it's like a personal decision, and a personal decision based on very often horrible circumstances, but always a personal decision. We never talk necessarily about the structural issues that lead someone to take these decisions. And what I mean by that is that there is a very unequal and abusive relationship that is established between the United States and places like El Salvador. They're at a great disadvantage when it comes to these bilateral relations. You know, they're very dependent on the United States for a lot of things. You know, they sell all their, you know, major commodities to the United States, such as coffee or cacao, you know, the sort of essence of chocolate. So, you know, there's that aspect of it. But also there's a huge amount of Salvadorans that live in the United States and send back remittances. They send back payments, essentially just parts of their paycheck. And that sustains the Salvadoran economy to a large extent. But they're not in a great position to negotiate any sort of, you know, better relationship as it is with their labor supply. I mean, the way that the systems have been set up in our modern economy is that we give visas to capital and to investors to go to these places and exploit these places, but we don't give visas to labor. Yet we exploit the labor supply. So that the notion is to keep the labor prices down, you know, you keep them illegal. And there's so many people who fall into this. We enjoy the fruits of that. I mean, you know, us in the United States, we have cheap coffee and we have cheap labor, you know, and it's largely a result of this system. So we don't think about or talk about immigration in those terms, but this is what leads people to be, you know, marginalized, you know, squeezed into these tight spaces in dense and urban environments, and live within these competitive environments in which gangs emerge. And gangs emerge in huge numbers in these places where these people settle. So we're talking about places like Los Angeles. When, you know, in the 1980s, when the MS-13 emerges, there are 400 gangs in Los Angeles County alone. It's the epicenter of gangs for a lot of reasons, but it has to do with the economic systems that we create around them and systematically marginalize so many people. The relationship between these gangs is complex and certainly dynamic, but the MS-13, to get to your question about Los Angeles, does not have a fluid relationship with any of these criminal gangs, you know, aside from the Mexican Mafia. And the reason they have this relationship with the Mexican Mafia is largely imposed by the Mexican Mafia. The Mexican Mafia is a rather small organization in numbers, anywhere between 100 and 120 actual members. They have a huge network, though, and that network extends throughout the prison system. So if you are Latino inside of a California state prison, you have to be under their umbrella. If you are not, you are going to face severe repercussions, especially if you're a member of a gang. So that's the way the prison system is divided up. It's divided up by race. And the Mexican Mafia in the southern part of California in particular runs the Latino sections of the prisons. So you have to have that relationship with them.
How loosely organized is MS-13? You tell us they're not a drug cartel or a terrorist organization. And if we do know anything about organizations that are into crime, we think about the five families of the mafia in New York, or we think about ISIS or Al-Qaeda. But this is a different kind of organization. And we don't really identify any one person as the leader of MS-13, do we?
No, they're organized by what I referred to earlier as cliques. And really, your loyalty is to your clique. These cliques are born in specific geographic spaces, named after those geographic spaces or streets or neighborhoods. You know, one was named after 7-Eleven they hung out near in the center of L.A., those sorts of things. You know, and that loyalty is mostly to your clique, you know, your clique first and then the sort of MS-13, you know, largely beyond that. So you have there exists a hierarchy, there exists rules, and you have to follow what that leader says. But between cliques, you'll very often have rivalries, have major differences that can lead to violence. You know, in many respects, you know, some of these cliques, which can be very large, you know, groups that connect different cliques by the same name across a huge geographic expanse. I mean, if I told you, the Hollywood clique, for instance, you know, has cliques in California, in Texas, on the East Coast, in Three Nations in Central America. It's almost a gang within a gang, if you think of it that way. You know, we talk about the MS-13 like it's this one big entity, and it is. There is a brand name, the MS-13, but they're really kind of many gangs within a gang. There is no central hierarchy, you know, making the decisions for everybody across this giant geographic expanse. You know, there are certainly leaders that are, you know, more powerful than others, but they don't control the gang as a whole. That's not how it works. And there's no master plan. This is a rudimentary hand-to-mouth criminal organization. They have tried on many, or individual members, I should say, have tried at various points to become more sophisticated, to become a drug trafficking organization, to employ things such as what the mafia might do. And they're not successful because that's not why they were organized. This goes back to the fact that they are a community first. They're a social organism first, and they're a criminal organism is second. You know, and the proof of that is that we've got 40 years of history to draw from, and they've got a perfect infrastructure to become a drug trafficking organization on an international level, and they've never done it. And why haven't they done it? Because they weren't set up to do it. So it makes for a very difficult thing for people to wrap their heads around, but they are not, you know, this huge, you know, cartel-like or mafia-like structure. That's not what they are.
And what are the members expected to do? What is required of them? Again, I'm playing back to the old mafia. We see them in their social clubs, and we know that they have to keep sending things up the chain in terms of their bounty and so forth. We know their obligations. We know their oath of emerita to really be silent about the actions of the family. What is required of somebody who joins MS-13?
You know, they do have rules that mirror, in some instances, what you think of as kind of mafia rules, the idea of omerta. I mean, that is a very central element to all of these quasi-criminal organizations, this idea that if you snitch on the group that you're a member of, well, that's kind of the worst sin, right? There are other rules that they have to follow that mirror elements of the mafia. For example, they do have to get permission to kill people. There's a system, you know, whereby they seek out permission from the upper echelons of the group, and then the upper echelons give them what's called the green light to take action. So those sorts of processes exist. There are other things that are sort of sociocultural things, you know, the prohibition of rape. You're not allowed to be a homosexual inside of the gang. You know, those sorts of things that in some instances would also, you know, mirrors at least some groups within the mafia. So there are elements for sure. But again, this is, you know, what are your obligations? I mean, you know, your obligations, you know, are to attend meetings, are to, you know, hand over a certain percentage of your earnings, and they could be illicit earnings or they could be licit earnings. Many of these guys are handing over 20, 30 bucks at a weekly meeting that they earned while landscaping. You know, this is what this is. It's, like I said, it's a rudimentary hand-to-mouth criminal organization. Now, they're then piled into a bank account that then is, you know, they're sending off, the equivalent of remittances. I mean, $500, $1,000 back to gang members in El Salvador, you know, via Western Union. This is the type of, you know, big time, you know, in quotations, criminal activities that you see with the MS-13. The worst part about the MS-13 is the propensity for collective violence. And that's kind of where they draw, you know, their fame from. I say it's the most notorious, and purposely avoid this idea of the most dangerous because it's not the most dangerous, but it is the most notorious, and very often because of these, you know, these violent, collective violent actions that they take, which does distinguish them in some instances from other groups, and their use of blunt instruments to, you know, cruelly attack and dismember their rivals or their perceived rivals. And this is the part of the gang that makes it really, you know, unruly and very much, first and foremost on the agenda of law enforcement. And I agree with that. You know, I mean, you do need to go after violent criminal gangs.
And of course, their use of machetes has gotten so much attention. Who are the victims primarily of a group like MS-13? You say in the book that they are Latinos, but how do you come into conflict with them?
Yeah, you come into conflict with them because you occupy the same spaces with them. There was a poll that was done with Republicans, you know, prior to the election of Donald Trump in 2016, and it asked them about this, and like a huge percentage of them, over 50%, were worried that they were going to be attacked, you know, by MS-13, and it just doesn't happen that way. They're not targeting people in the suburbs, you know, they're not targeting people in those spaces. They're targeting people in their own spaces, and their own spaces are Latino communities where they live, where they emerged, you know, in the school systems, where they go to school, you know, in some instances in the spaces where there are vibrant criminal economies, where drugs are being sold, or there's prostitution, or other forms of illicit activities. Those are the spaces in which people are being, you know, attacked and in some cases, dismembered. the victims look like they do. The victims are from the same spaces. They're often suffering the same things. They're suffering from the, you know, the domestic abuse, the sexual abuse that many of them suffer from inside the homes. And then the violence that's occurring outside of the homes as well, the other gang violence. And what they see is as state repression, you know, systematic state repression against them.
How does the Latino community look at MS-13? And after 40 years of being somewhere in the United States, and particularly concentrated in the Los Angeles area, have they become, not reputable by any means, but have they become part of the scene? Have they become politically influential? Have they grown outside of where they might have started as outsiders and those looking for social connection by virtue of this gang?
It's such a good question, because you do see that evolution in other gangs. I remember the Latin Kings trying to create the essence of a political organization in Chicago, for example. But you don't see that in the U.S. with the MS-13 and what they're, and how are they seen? You know, I can, you know, of course we're generalizing here, but, you know, they're seen as predators, in many cases. And it certainly, you know, you have this complex, nuanced view, especially those who, you know, live in these spaces and have to deal with them. They do understand that they are victims and that they are victimizers. That's complex, and that's a lot of people in a lot of spaces, but mostly it's seen as a largely predatory group, you know, stay away from them, keep out of their way, you know, and, you know, that sort of thing, you know, you'll mostly be okay in the spaces in the United States. Now, in places like El Salvador, the predatory nature is at another level. You know, and recruitment is much stronger. The impetus to join these organizations is much greater, because the areas in which they operate are, you know, are contested areas. You know, they have rivals that will go after you if you don't have that backup. You know, so there may be greater incentives in places like El Salvador for you to have some sort of affiliation with the gang. And the gangs, you know, in El Salvador have grown much more politically. There's much more interaction on a political level, between the gang leadership and political leaders. And that includes all the way to assisting political parties in getting their leaders elected president. You know, so that's a very high-level political interaction that you see in a place like El Salvador that you do not see at all in the United States.
You say that there are three types of gang prevention strategies: primary, secondary, tertiary. Briefly, tell us what you think we might be able to do to reduce the influence of MS-13. In some of your writing in the New York Times back in 2018, you said that there's something about religion that might help if we began to understand their interest in those kinds of experiences and look at them, as you say, more as a social organization than a criminal enterprise.
There's a lot to unpack there, obviously, but what we see on the surface is law and order, right? That effort. What I'm talking about there is much more targeted intervention, either specific members themselves to extract them from the life, or if they have the danger of falling into the life. And one of the means by which they do leave very often is the evangelical church. So I think we need to pay attention to these avenues through which they leave and try and understand these alternative communities that can be created, that can compete with gang life. That's the evangelical church. At least that's one that's most manifest to me. There are much longer term strategies I think we have to implement, such as early family intervention strategies to, you know, make sure that we are dealing with physical and sexual abuse in the home, those sorts of things. But if we're talking about the sort of targeted interventions in creation of alternative spaces, you know, then we can look to the evangelical church as a thing to, you know, help us understand gang life in general. If they see a parallel, why do they see a parallel? Why do they accept evangelical church as a means by which they can leave the gang. Let's try and understand that, and maybe we can figure out better strategies to mitigate their influence.
Is there anything about Central American policy, as we see a change in administrations in the United States, where we could help those countries solidify their stability as political entities and avoid what we see coming into the United States and this back and forth that goes on with lots of new recruits possible given the interplay between the Americas and the United States?
A lot of policy that crosses over administrations in places like Central America, I would assume that it will cross over now as well. And this has to do, again, with assisting the, development of police, the development, especially in terms of infrastructure and training of the prison system. So that's very, very specific to kind of putting out the fire, if you will. And then there are other programs that will continue that have to do with these primary, secondary, and tertiary efforts, which is all the different spaces in which you can, target possible gang members and at-risk youth to give them alternatives. And I think those will continue, if not expand, if and when the administration changes in the next few months.
In closing, MS. What is this shorthand for, because I don't want to leave this podcast without telling people?
It stands for Mara Salvatruta. The Mara is a euphemism in El Salvador for kind of a rambunctious group of friends. And the Salvatrucha is broken into two pieces. Salva is a reference to El Salvador. Trucha means sort of savvy or street smart. So you put it all together and you get a gang name, Mara Salvatrucha.
Very interesting. And the 13?
The 13 is a reference to the letter M, and that's paying homage to the Mexican mafia that I referenced earlier, the prison gang, because it's the 13th letter in the alphabet.
Stephen Dudley, MS-13, The Making of America's Most Notorious Gang, and a book that's gotten incredible acclaim, and rightfully so. Thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Thank you for having me.